Welcome to Ad Exchanger Talks, the podcast devoted to examining the issues and trends in advertising and marketing technology that matter most to you.
This episode is sponsored by Zephyr, a leading contextual data platform for brands and agencies. Later in this episode, I speak with Zephyr co-CEO Richard Radden about the company's human-in-the-loop approach to brand suitability, specifically built with video in mind. Hey everybody, welcome back to Ad Exchanger Talks. This is Zach Rogers. I'm the executive editor of Ad Exchanger. So my guest today is Ravi Patel. Ravi is an entrepreneur who has dedicated the past several years of his career to helping brands make better advertising decisions by adding financial style intelligence to their programmatic dashboards. He did this originally at AdFin, his previous company, where he was the VP of product and the head of data, and then later became the CEO. AdFin's product allowed agencies and trading desks to analyze historical pricing information based on independently verified information. It was an ambitious model, and it didn't work out. We'll talk about why. More recently, Ravi works at PricewaterhouseCoopers as the developer of consumer markets and product lead. Among other things, he's trying to continue the story he started at AdFin, building a media intelligence business unit that marketers and agency buyers can use to continuously improve the efficiency of their programmatic campaigns. Hope I got all that right. Ravi will correct me if I did not. I'm delighted to have him on the show. Ravi, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Zach. No, you got it perfectly, just as you said.
Oh, good. So good to have you on the show. We've been talking about doing this for a while. You and I have been, every now and then we do a Zoom call, or back in the day we would get a coffee or lunch and talk about stuff. And I'm glad we're finally able to do a public podcast.
Yeah, likewise. I think it's been a long time coming. 2020 is kind of a wacky year for all of us.
Yes, good riddance. So I summarized what AdFin was there, but I thought maybe for the beginning part of our interview, we could talk about the AdFin story, because it's an interesting story. And you've been very sort of open about sharing what happened, what the vision was, and then what ultimately went wrong. But maybe you could put in your own words, what was the founding idea with AdFin? What were you trying to do?
Definitely. So, AdFin, the name itself came out of the whole finance ecosystem, advertising financials. So when the company was started, it was started with the idea of becoming the Bloomberg terminal of the ad tech ecosystem, allowing everyone across the industry to see what was the price of media across different channels, specifically the programmatic channel. Now, if you take a look at why Bloomberg Terminal was started, right, it was to create greater market transparency in the financial markets. And they did a really, really good job doing that. And when you achieve that full transparency, or visibility and control, as I like to call it, you can make better investment decisions. And whether that's across, finance, advertising, real estate, and that's really what we wanted to do. We wanted to provide brands, agencies, and the entire ecosystem a more complete and reliable information set. And we believe that the better the markets work, it benefits the entire ecosystem,
Great. And so the idea was not just to help marketers take look at their own pricing data historically and across supply sources and users and other platforms, but also to benchmark themselves against industry-wide independently verified data, correct?
Exactly. And take it even a step further, right? The long-term goal was to create similar financial products that exist. Like, you think about forwards, contracts, and everything like that. Imagine you be a brand being able to buy a specific set of publishers or publishers for December 25th of 2021. And through the year, they can determine if that inventory set still works for them or not. They just get into a contract. And with that pricing transparency, you unlock all these other features that really work well in the finance ecosystem.
Okay, great. And it was tricky to pull all this together, as I understand it, partly because you're asking a bunch of different players to expose log level data to you. So in a way that you can then package it and share it with clients. right? So, and that was a bit of a, that was a bit, a big ask. Fair?
Sure. So a lot of, you know, originally when AdFin was started, it wasn't really a contractual limitation that existed afterwards, but more of a technical limitation. A lot of the players across the ecosystem just didn't have a way to provide log files because they didn't know how to generate log files or they never stored log files.
Got you. Okay, good. So, and then there were the contractual issues and sort of sensitivities around this data. And I don't know, I don't want to jump the gun here because this, you know, some of the, there was a little bit of controversy around the, an ANA Ebiquity report that you were involved in. And I think that before we get to that, I want to make sure that we've sort of painted the whole picture for the audience about where you had brought the business to and what your early growth and momentum were. Could you speak to that for a minute before we get into the...
Definitely. So, you know, this was also prior to my time. AdFin was an incubated company, right? It was really started by a lot of high net worth investors, specifically from the finance and real estate ecosystem that really thought this could benefit the advertising ecosystem. Now, they didn't understand fully how the advertising ecosystem worked. And that's where it came to fruition. That's why the emphasis on financial systems and how we kind of bring that into this ecosystem. I think before we spent a lot of time in productization, right? We knew that log files were really granular. There was no database or data warehouse at the time that could even ingest this kind of data, right? Even when you tried to do it manually, it was a very arduous task. And what we created was our own proprietary set of data warehouse, our own database, as well as our proprietary platform in order to solve this. And that productization effort took a lot longer than we initially thought. And a lot of that came from not being able to procure data.
Okay, great. So for the technical reasons you said earlier, but then later for human reasons, competitive reasons and frankly, a little bit of, is resentment too strong a word? That came out of the ANA Ebiquity project. So let's talk about that. This was something that you guys jumped into. It was around the time, the very early days of sort of brands having suspicions about their supply chains and specifically about rebates that were being paid by some technology and media companies to agencies in exchange for advertising commitments. So this was an industry-wide scandal, I would say. And I think how you feel about this particular industry scandal depends on where you sit in the industry, whether you're an advertiser, whether you're an agency, whether you're a technology or a media company. But in any case, we won't make value judgments on this podcast, but the ANA, representing the largest brands in the United States, undertook to study the problem. And to do so, they partnered with a company called Ebiquity, which in turn outsourced part of their research to you. Could you speak about that and how that came about?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of that ANA study came out because a brand executive, if you recall, at an ANA conference kind of stood up in an audience of everyone and just said, hey, there's a lot of rebates and there's a lot of, opaqueness in this ecosystem that you aren't looking at. And, you know, that a lot of agencies and the ecosystem is skimping fees. That's what really opened the eyes to the ANA as well as to the advertisers to really take this and run with it. So it originally started, yes, with Ebiquity and the ANA partnering, and then they brought in AdFin as the technology provider to help kind of understand because no one knew how to look at log files like we did. And they didn't have a system in place to go and, you know, process billions and billions of impressions across the study and be able to see in depth what's happening. And that's how it really got started from there. Now, how it went about was not easy either. And we can talk a little bit about that as well, because the process itself was pretty taxing.
Taxing for you all or for the agencies you were working with?
I think more so for the vendors, right? We have to chase down and help educate the ecosystem on log files and why we need them and why we couldn't go off of just the aggregated data that was reported out, because that didn't give us that visibility into the supply chain and the fees involved, such as third-party fees. So for a small startup of Advin, you know, size with 20 people, you're spending a lot of your resources trying to go and complete the study and not enough and kind of going out to the market and selling. And, you know, we were early stage startup at the time, so it was very difficult to kind of balance both.
Yeah, got it. Cool. And then now, and so then you had a bunch of agencies who were being asked to work with you to provide transparent data so that brands could assess this problem, which involved to some extent what brands viewed as agency greed or inappropriate practices. So there was a bit of like fear and sort of anxiety from these agencies about being part of a report like this. Fair to say?
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes from the fact that I think a lot of agencies also didn't know what they were getting themselves into. I mean, if you take back to it, we didn't exclude the agencies from this study. We actually tried to include the agency organization as well and see like, how can we all partner together and really drive a study across the entire ecosystem together? And the way that, you know, the pieces fell is it would just ended up being ANA, Ubiquity, and Advin at the end.
Okay, got it. It could have been agency involved, but they didn't play.
Yeah, or weren't interested, right?
Right. So was there a point where you realized that, you know, being aligned with this big industry research project about rebates was hurting Advin?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the big things when you're building a technology company, it's very important to have channel partners, right? That's what helps you really scale. You think about some of Advin's competitors, and some have done really well, gotten acquisitions. But the other piece is when you take on a study of this size across the entire ecosystem, you're basically taking your entire team and focusing on this and not focusing on product market fit and what you need to actually build out. So it did kind of not just distract us, but at the same time, you know, it raised eyebrows on the agency side, where we had instances in the past, you know, where we just wouldn't be able to get data. They would call it a financial audit. And, you know, those are just two of the cases. But yeah, we had to fight tooth and nail for it afterwards.
Okay, great. And then so it wasn't just about sort of having to deal with agency resistance. It was about the amount of work that this project took up for you. Fair?
Yeah, I would say project, but more so that because of the data and the problem we were trying to solve. Okay. Right.
Yeah, got it. So what eventually happened to Advin? How'd the story end? And what were the lessons learned for you?
I think, you know, before we go to the Advin story, we think about what it kind of opened up the industry to, and we came and understood something totally different than what we went to solve. We went to solve what are the prices paid in the ecosystem. What we came out with was a first ever inspection into how advertiser budgets were actually spent, right, across the digital supply chain, understanding where are the fees and where should we be looking. You know, out of that, we spent a lot of money to do the study. You know, we worked with, let's say, the ANA and also Reed Smith and stuff to help provide our input into crafting the templates that exist today around data agreements, contractual language for log files and all that good stuff. But it was a difficult time. Also, we spent a lot of time in working with the industry to get it up and not enough time in going and selling the solution to the industry. And because of that, you know, 6-7 years of a startup taking money from investors every year is a long time, right? Investors are in it to make a buck. And if we can't turn sales around and we couldn't really scale up, that's what we did for the past, you know, 2.5-3 years of the Advin journey. And it was going really well, but we just kind of ran out of runway in a way.
Wow, yeah. And, you know, I'm really struck by, this was the very early days of the the supply chain debate, the idea, you know, something brands sometimes call the ad tech tax or whatever, but just the idea that you don't the programmatic was a black box and that needs to change because the programmatic wasn't going away. So it needs to be opened up and understood better because a lot of brands, buyers just couldn't say exactly where their dollar was being spent and how much money was allocated to each stop along the way. And so, but you were working fairly early in that sort of realization process to help, to assist in sort of solving this technology challenge. Unfortunately, some of the key players never achieve the scale or business success they need to become successful companies. So I'm sorry that didn't work out for you at AdFin. When you look back and you look at the technology that you've developed there, what do you see as being the sort of the legacy, and who are the key players who are carrying forward this technology challenge in 2021?
Yeah, I think the biggest legacy pieces, and this is, you know, at this time I was just running a product side of things and data side of things at AdFin. I give it, you know, props to the former CEO who really had a difficult task opening up the eyes of the ecosystem and helping to do that, right? Understanding what a log file is and why the importance of log files, especially as you move in the programmatic ecosystem. You go back to the, you know, mid-2000s when programmatic was really born. And a lot of the reason was the ability to control your buys, the ability to target. And what it turned into is something where you just turn on to charge a lot of fees. And you don't really get addressability out of it, right? Like you're targeting geo and stuff, but you're not really using programmatics to its full potential. And with the whole emergence of log files and how it can be powered and all the data that you get off, it allowed you to build a data asset that no one thought of before. And, you know, to kind of hit off of that is this ecosystem and many others are still very relationship driven, right? It's all around who you know and, you know, how you can help them and benefit them. And that's where, as a startup, as especially a technology startup, you go and get answers around what are a customer's pain points. I think at times we got to a point where we were building vitamins and not painkillers. And to provide an analogy is, Zach, if you had a headache, right, a migraine, and you were downstairs, you're going to come up and come get that Excedrin because it hurts. That's a painkiller. A vitamin, if you forgot your multivitamin for the day, you're not coming back today. You'll just take it tomorrow. It's a nice to have, right? Mm-hmm. Not a need to have. And I think a lot of the AdFin platform evolved to a nice to have, having gone down, you know, kind of not listening to the market and selling it into the market properly.
Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing that story and the transparency. We're going to move on to the second segment focused on what's going on over at PricewaterhouseCoopers. But first, we're going to hear from a sponsor. I'll be right back with Ravi. Hi, I'm happy to be talking with Rich Radden, co-CEO with our sponsor, Zephyr. Rich, over the last few years, brand safety has gone from a nice-to-have to a need-to-have for advertisers, and it seems like brand suitability is the new trend. What is Zephyr seeing in this space?
So we all know in 2017, when it hit the front pages of a lot of publications, that there were some brand safety issues on the platforms. The platforms have, over the last few years, have done a wonderful job in cleaning up the brand safety issues, but it really opened marketers' eyes to the diversity and complexity of content on these vast and important platforms. And so because of that, suitability came into the mix. And prior to GARM and the 4A's APB, establishing an actual architecture from whence to look at brand suitability, they defined 11 categories and 44 thresholds, a floor, a low, a medium, and a high. And that was a structure in which brands could start transacting and looking and analyzing brand suitability. And so we're super excited about the work that those organizations have done. And that's why brand suitability is really in the mix right now and has a lot of marketers talking about it, because with the diversity of content on the platforms, brands need to be able to be specific about what they feel comfortable in a content adjacency world being around.
Talk a little bit about the contextual technology space. It's been around a long time. What's your point of view on the contextual industry?
Yeah, this, so contextual technologies are the ways that marketers leverage, are able to activate around brand suitability. And what we see in the contextual space is there's a lot of legacy players that are active in this space that use literally legacy technology stacks that analyze text or metadata around the video. And what we found is that's just not a very accurate way to determine what a video is about. So many times, especially on user uploaded or user generated sites, the text is actually not all that accurate or indicative of the content. And so we prefer a technology stack that's built around human cognition or actually human reviews. So using algorithms and data and machine learning, but instead of using as the training data, the metadata associated with the video, we actually use humans that are reviewing content that are informing the algorithms.
So human review is a way to understand the context of videos. Could you talk a little more about that approach?
Yeah, very specifically, a human looking at a piece of video content in a millisecond can determine whether a piece of content, so for instance, if it's a makeup video, they can see whether it's Halloween makeup or beauty makeup. A human very easily can sense that. And we can actually teach a machine to be able to replicate those patterns. But that's the power of human cognition. It's that things intuitively that a human can understand that it's very challenging for a machine to understand. But if you use that as a training set of data, you just get much more accurate, nuanced results.
How do you foresee brands ensuring their ad dollars are being spent within suitable environments?
Well, we think GARM and we think the APBs have done an incredible job. They've taken subjectivity out of suitability, we like to say, because they've come up with a very strict framework in which to look at suitability, the 11 categories, the 11 problematic categories, and a floor, low, medium, and high risk tolerance with each of those categories. So they've gone to great lengths to define what those categories are and what determines a low risk content and what determines medium and high risk content. Our hope is that brands and marketers will start to transact off of those suitability definitions and guardrails, because it's a wonderful way to ensure that brands are being are actually getting the proper type of content adjacency when they utilize the GARM and APB framework from which to activate their media dollars and actually measure their media dollars as well in video.
All right, Rich Radden, co-CEO with Zephyr. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Zach.
And I'm back with Ravi. So, you know, when I think of PwC, I think of the reports that they do with the IAB sizing the market for digital advertising. And I know they have an advisory business, but I don't think I have my head completely wrapped around PricewaterhouseCoopers business and where it's going. Could you speak a little bit to what its offer to the market has been historically and how that's evolving over time?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the biggest things is PwC, as we, you know, call it, is a company that's known for its auditing business and its consultancy and advisory, right, specifically in the CFO organization and also the executive organizations. Over time, what they've been privy to are a lot of the information in order to productize offerings directly for their clients. And what I mean by that is, we just spoke about earlier, hey, we didn't listen to the market. We didn't, you know, if we had listened to the market, maybe we wouldn't have gone down the log file track. Maybe we would have focused on other things such as aggregated data, which would have at least solved the needs of the brand at that time. And PwC has access to a lot of that, and they can answer a lot of brand questions, and they do answer them today, right? So what they're enabling through this is ability to productize offerings that work for the ecosystem, that answer questions for the brands, that answer pain points due to their robust consulting feedback around the different really verticals.
How much of that has been qualitative versus quantitative?
So in terms of the early feedback into the product, you know, a lot of it is what are clients looking at? How are they looking at things? And then the quantitative kind of feedback loop really comes in once we deliver on the product, right? It's when we start bringing in that data and we start answering those questions and seeing where else do we need to iterate or what else do we need to change, really.
Okay, and so what phase of it are you in? And did this predate your involvement, Ravi, or did they hire you to get this thing off the ground?
No, this predated my involvement. So, you know, PwC has been investing heavily in kind of across the different verticals to answer these questions. And they had started on this media intelligence platform largely, you know, in early 2020. A lot of this came to being, as you remember, the ISBA study that also just came out last year, that kind of also showed that, hey, listen, there is still a lot of questions around the ecosystem, programmatic, but what they decided to build with media intelligence was across all the channels and not just one, because there's a lot of just as many questions across the walled gardens as there is across programmatic these days.
Okay, great. And could you, let's see, what's the right way into this? I guess I'm curious to hear, maybe what might be helpful is to hear a use case, even if it's a hypothetical use case, for how PwC's clients engage with the media intelligence practice. And how that might, you know, serve them better as you continue along your product roadmap here. What would be like a scenario where, you know, for a client of this practice?
Yeah, so let's start with one. One of them is over or under billings across all your channels, right? Clients right now basically get reports saying, this is the invoice, let's pay it. There's no really checks and balances in place to understand how much did I actually spend across my Facebook spend, across my programmatic spend, and across which partners. Brands are also getting smarter and they're creating partnerships with SSPs, and they have some, you know, specific kind of agreements with them as well. So being able to answer all those questions through the power of the platform, because all that data is in one place now, you have this one view across it all. And we've gotten, you know, to the point where now you can also initiate make goods through the platform. And what I mean by make goods is in TV, if you were buying the same ad slot as your competitors, a best practice is to get a make good on that, right? And in digital, the same thing can be said for fraud, viewability, or not buying to what the media plan had indicated. So being able to bring all this data, which a lot of advertisers don't have the tool sets or even the teams to put together, right? They should focus on the insights and what it says and how they formulate their strategy and less on how do I get this data? How do I put it together? How do I normalize it? And that's what we're going out and solving.
Okay. So it sounds blockchain-y in a way, just like direct visibility to each, you know, supplier and prices paid. And I noticed you're an advisory, you were on the advisory board for AminoPay, which was a blockchain based payment tracking system, which sort of speaks to the same need. Could you talk about that a little bit? Like, do you see blockchain as being part of the future solution for this industry? I wasn't planning to ask this, but it just occurred to me while you were giving your last answer.
No worries. You know, blockchain to me, especially around the 2015 to 2018, 2019 standpoint, turned into this term to for a lot of startups to raise money, or the blockchain for X. Blockchain, if you think about it, is very similar to just a database, right? When you add information into it, it's just immutable. You can't go delete it in the end. Can it turn into blockchain? I personally don't like calling it blockchain, right? I just say that, listen, this is a system of record for paid media in a way. I don't know if I'll personally be able to push it as a blockchain solution, because I think
sounds like you wouldn't want to anyway. But, you know, just, is it because blockchain just seems a little like scammy now?
I wouldn't say scammy. It's a real technology, right? But I think it's almost like trying to sell you a Ferrari when you just need a Honda Civic to go from A to B, right? I just don't think it's needed, and it's just extra costs and extra pieces in the ecosystem that are not needed. Imagine blockchain. If you're trying to verify every impression, you need the SSP, the publisher, the DSP, the ad server on the brand side to all give you all the impressions, and then being able to add it to the block and validate it and everything. I just don't think that's necessary today, because that's going to take you from, you got to first get to the first 99% to solve that last 1%.
Okay, great. So for PwC and the media intelligence practice, Could you talk a little more about what types of data we're talking about? Is it a lot of pricing data? Are there other data types that you're looking to bring together here?
Yeah, so the premise we go, the media intelligence platform goes in is building global insights, right? That's pricing data, performance data, but also a piece that was really missing. And this is, you know, one of the big reasons why I was really driven to it is the audience piece. The cookieless environment is coming. How do you kind of get to audiences? How do you activate audiences? So the media intelligence platform takes a look at the media side, takes a look at the audience side and combines them together to help answer a lot of questions that still can't be answered today. As far as the actual data, it's across all channels, whether that's, you know, search, social, TV, whatever granularity of data that's available. Let's say walled gardens will never give us log files. So I guess never say never, but for the foreseeable future, I haven't seen anything where the walled gardens are going to give us log files. But what you can do is not just get your campaign level reports, but be able to break it down using the API connections into different queries so that you can pull as much granularity as possible, which includes demographic data, which includes audience data, which also includes performance data and also conversion data.
Okay, so that's a lot of database cells. How do you take all of that information and make it accessible?
It goes back to our Advent days. I think this is sometimes, you know, when we think about it, right time, right place is very important, right? To be a first mover doesn't always work. You look at MySpace and Facebook. MySpace was first, Facebook still won. You look at electric vehicles with GM and Tesla. GM came out with their first electric vehicle in 1996. It still flopped. Tesla's lifting off today. So the database technologies have caught up, and there's a lot of third-party databases. It's how you put it together and how you kind of pull in that data and normalize it. That's where, and I wouldn't say it's secret sauce, but I would say that's where we have very deep knowledge in understanding the data across the different ecosystems and being able to normalize it so that campaign in Facebook means the same thing as campaign in Trade Desk. Because right now everyone has their own nomenclature across it all.
Okay, great. Now, how different is this or similar is this to business intelligence, which is something that's long existed outside of the marketing area?
Yeah, so business intelligence is, when it comes to it, it's visualization and analytics that you kind of build out, right? What we're providing is the best, the top learned aspects of what you need to look at from a media side. So there is a BI tool on top of it, right? Something that allows the visualization of the data. So think of us as a data warehouse plus a BI tool on top. So it's similar in that sense, but not every brand team has a BI team that can go and understand each data set, see what's important to them across each data set, make sure everything is normalized across each data set. And we're trying to bring it out to the larger brand group as it goes, especially after COVID. I've heard so many brands that have unfortunately had to really lower their teams, you know, have a smaller team and be able to operate the same without a few people or a lot of people in that sense.
Right. Got you. Now, do you have the resources you need at PwC to execute on this product vision? And, you know, is there a chance you guys would raise money or acquire technology assets? I don't know who owns the AdFin technology at this point, but could you speak to that a little bit, resourcing this project?
Yeah, so PwC has a separate area called PwC Digital, which works on just the product and engineering focus, part of the business. And then the verticals kind of help in understanding, okay, what should we be building? There are business go-to-market teams, essentially. So PwC is staffed up in that, right? They're not holding anything back. They're going all in because they know that this is what's going to really help their clients in the future. And this is also what's going to create stickiness with their clients in the future. So when it comes to that, it's nothing needed. As far as acquisitions go, listen, that's anything is possible. That's probably above my pay grade now up to the executive level as well. Mm-hmm. I think as far as everything goes right now, they've built their own insights platform, which are a bunch of tool sets for a lot of brands across not just advertising, but other ecosystem to solve BI related issues or data science related issues. And then we built a media intelligence platform. And this is just two of a portfolio of products they've built out over the past few years.
Okay. Got you. Are there, Maybe you could speak to the competitive set a little bit. You know, when you look across the industry, who do you think is trying to solve the same problems you are, and what's your view of the?
Yeah, I think, you know, the closest I would have said to what we were kind of solving, at least to the granularity, was AminoPay. And you must have heard they got acquired by IAS, which is a great win for that team.
I did see that. Yes.
I think it's, you know, the timing is right now for that. A lot of the media teams, a lot of the vendors are starting to look into this area and say, hey, you know, brands are starting to take notice and gain that visibility and control across their campaigns, across their media spend. They want their media investments to go further than it's ever been. There's only so much of suppressing margin, whether it's a DSP fee or an agency fee in the end. So,
right. And so talk about the next 1 to 2 years, Ravi. If everything goes smoothly, what will you be sharing with me on the podcast in 2023?
You know, I think this year is we're onboarding a lot of clients, specifically in the global CPG area. What we want to get to, or what I personally want to get to, let's say that is, I'd like to help create industry transparency and visibility under across the different channels. As it's hard to say digital benchmarks, and I know it, since it's a biddable environment, it's the wrong thing to say, but it's still important to know how year over year prices are going and how that impacts what you buy. And if advertisers can learn to take control of that and be able to answer those questions, what I paid for a dollar last year produced, you know, $2 in revenue or conversions. What's going to happen if I spent $1.25 today because prices are going up, but how are they fluctuating? Mm. Hopefully we get to a point where we could start sharing a lot of this benchmark data and telling good stories. Because I think a lot of the ecosystem has been around, no one's really focused on how to do it. Everything's been around what to do.
Mm-hmm. All right. Wonderful. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on to talk about all this stuff. We're going to leave it there. Ravi Patel, PwC. Thanks so much.
Zach, thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of this podcast. We'll see you next time. This podcast is supported by Zephr. Zephr is the leading contextual data platform for brands and agencies. Rather than relying on misleading things like keywords or publisher names, Zephr takes a different approach for video. They've patented a human-in-the-loop approach to brand suitability, specifically built with video in mind.